Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by all of you because none of us is as smart as all of us. And by the way, I love it when you tweet me that.
This week, Molly and I are going to do the first ever Make Me Smart Explain-a-thon.
Yeah, there is both terror and excitement right now. We are going to answer as many questions from you as we can reasonably fit into one show. And then we're going to take some questions from a few callers in real time. That is the terrifying part. Nah. And then Kai and I have a question for each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then
did you prepare? Your homework, Rizdahl?
By the time we get there, I will have a question. And then we're going to stop talking and let one of you answer the Make Me Smart question. So here we go.
Welcome to the Explain-a-thon.
Why are you laughing?
Because our music is so spectacular.
It is kind of interesting. All right, so here's the deal. You guys send us a lot of questions. There's a form on our website. There's Twitter. There's Facebook emails. We are literally in the thousands of questions for us. Some we answer on the program. Some we turn into whole episodes. Some get answered in digital form. But we can't obviously do all of them, right? So we're going to do an every now and then thing on this podcast called the Explain-a-thon. Where we are going to answer as many questions as we can, as Molly said, as reasonably fit into an episode. And I don't know what reasonably fit means, but we're going to find out.
It's not going to be 1,000. I can tell you that.
Okay.
But right. I do think I am having an idea in real time, and I think it would be awesome if the next Explain-a-thon was you guys answering questions that we have. Because we get emails also of people answering questions that we have, and people are brilliant.
That's actually a really good idea.
Right? Let's totally do it. Let's make it because it's not always just we were saying this a lot in the beginning of the podcast, but it seems worth repeating now that it's not all about us making you smart.
Yep.
It's making each other smart and everybody getting smarter together. I whacked the microphone. I was so worked up about it. Also, I was doing my little explain-a-thon dance with my elbows,
No dancing.
In terms of this show, we have not seen these questions in advance. Our producers did take pity on us because I think I asked so many times, like, "What do we know the answers? Are you sure we know the answers?" So we got a list of general subject categories to DuckDuckGo in advance.
Yes.
And then if we can't answer a question, we get to play the Pass to Tony card, which is we have Tony Wagner on our digital team answer the question on our website later this week, which frankly is what he does almost every week anyway. It's like pick
true.
Up the ball when we drop it. And blog it.
It's also known as us just punting, right?
Yeah, exactly. Help us, Tony. So now we're just making it official. We're just making it canon. And you will know that we're passing a question because you'll hear this sound.
Wow. Oh. What an interesting sound.
It's like a rocket to Tony.
So first set of questions we're going to do is ones that you all have sent us via voice memo.
Our favorite. And our first of those comes from Brian Bush of Columbus, Indiana.
My question is about stock earnings forecasts. How does a company decide the number to use for their next quarter and next yearly guidance? Wall Street loves it when a company beats their forecast. So why don't all companies sandbag their forecast to beat Wall Street and increase their stock price? Please help me understand which way forecast earnings guidance is better, I guess one for the company and also for Wall Street.
Well, so I'm just going to assume this is a question for me.
Me too.
Right?
I'm assuming that too.
And, and really, okay. All right. So really the first thing to say, Brian, is how do you know companies aren't sandbagging their forecasts? I'm just saying. Well, the answer is because it's a violation of SEC regulation and federal law, and nobody wants to do that. So here's the deal, right? And you hear this all the time on Wall Street in coverage and in the papers, and thankfully not a whole lot on Marketplace. It's called the number, right? And it's the number that companies are expected to hit. Sometimes it's called a whisper number because Wall Street starts whispering about what this company or that is going to make in any given quarter. And it's usually the number itself is usually denominated in earnings per share because that is, in theory, what individual shareholders worry about. But when you talk about forecasts, you're talking about all kinds of things, top line and bottom line revenues. You're talking about EBITDA. You're talking about cost of acquisition of customers. It's the entire financial statement that companies issue and are required to issue by federal law by the Securities Act of 1934. And they look at all kinds of things. They look at sales projections that their experts in, you know, green eye shades are making for how many iPhones they're going to sell. They look at how much it's going to cost them if they're, say, Snapchat or Blue Apron's a really good example. How much it's going to cost them to acquire new customers, which in Blue Apron's case is a lot of money, which is why they're in some trouble. So they take all those and they roll them together and they put them out on what's called an earnings call once a quarter. And Wall Street takes it as gospel. The problem is that as companies are doing this, research firms and investment banks and analysts are doing the same thing. They have access to some degree of the information that the company has, not all of it, obviously, because it's proprietary, but they've got their own expectations and projections. And so research analysts come out with their numbers. And the problem that companies run into is when analysts have their number and companies have their number and they don't match. It's fine when they beat. That's lovely. But when companies fail to meet analysts' expectations, everybody goes, oh, my God. Now, that's how and why it works. I will. And it works that way because it has to, because that's what when you have a publicly traded corporation, you want that disclosure. You want that degree of transparency, right, about the business prospects of this company. I will tell you that it is not necessarily a good thing that Wall Street analysts have that much power, that they can, in essence, determine a company's fate by their own projections when, by definition, they don't have all the information. There have been many tries at getting rid of quarterly reporting systems, but, you know, you want that transparency. You want to know what's going on. The question is, how do you reconcile what analysts think and what the company thinks? And therein lies the disconnect. End of sermon.
Dude, that was amazing. So the shortest possible version is they don't sandbag because they can't, because people know the information that they're using.
Because they can't.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh.
Right.
I had no idea. This is already awesome.
So there you go. All right. So that's number one. Andy Curtis has another question. Here he is.
Ever since I saw Watson compete on Jeopardy in 2011, I've showed clips to my students as we discuss technology. However, I'm surprised that there doesn't seem to be a voice assistant that functions like Watson, widely and commercially available. But I would say that is probably the voice assistant everyone is hoping for, one that can listen to a variety of different ways of speaking and respond intelligently. So I guess if you can make me smart about why voice assistant technology isn't there, that would be awesome.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great question. I think voice assistant technology isn't there for the same reason that we imagine that robots can do all these things that they can't, but it's actually still really hard for them to just pick up an object without crushing it. It's very, very hard technology. And voice assistant technology in particular combines a whole bunch of really hard things. So on the one hand, you have to have the database of answers, and so you have to have sufficient data to anticipate lots of different kinds of questions. Then you have to have natural language processing, which is probably one of the single hardest problems that artificial intelligence has to solve, which is to just understand the way that people ask a question. It's, you know, I mean, back in the early days of search, you were really a good search hacker if you knew, like, Boolean, you know, how to phrase a question in this sort of Boolean terms, and then you'd use the right combination of, like, quotes and parentheses and whatever to get the right answer. And search has sort of magically evolved over time to be able to just for me to be like, what's that song with the thing deal in it, but that lady with the good hair? And then I get an answer, which is all by itself phenomenal. So you've got data sets, natural language processing, and then you have the voice part, which is that it has to hear you in whatever location you're in. It has to be able to parse what you're actually saying. It has to understand you properly, which I would say is probably, to me, it feels like that's more than half the battle, is just it hearing the right thing. But you got kids yelling at it. And so I think it's the fact that it's as good as it is actually pretty impressive. And that's, it's hard for me to admit that, because I do often want to curse at Siri and try to understand why it's so bad. But when you combine all of those three things, to me, that's the answer about why, for example, the Echo is not as good as it could be. The Echo could be great if it just had Google behind it. But instead, the data set that they're using is this sort of weird combination of, like, Amazon's catalog and Wolfram Alpha math and all of these things that aren't just a search engine. And so Google Home is a more satisfying experience in some ways because it has answers to more things because Google's behind it. But then when you add on all that other stuff, it just makes it incredibly different, difficult, like tri-level difficult. And I think that's probably why.
Tri-level.
But really short term, we should be glad that AIs aren't better because, you know, Elon Musk says they're going to kill us all.
Well, I was just going to say, let me have a little follow-up here, if I may. And this is not my official Stump Molly question. What do you think of Mr. Musk and his AI is going to kill us all?
You know, I did this really interesting interview recently with Peter Ng, Andrew Ng, who is a renowned AI expert. And what he said is people who think that AI is going to kill us all, I'm totally spoiling this because it hasn't even aired yet. But he said people who think that AI is going to kill us all are generally people who don't understand AI very well, which I thought was super shade. But it is, in their minds, it's so far off because there's so much training that has to happen of the computers. The data sets have to be sufficient for them to get that smart. They have to awaken at some point. I mean, it's sort of like it's such the jump between where we are now and the possibility of sentient computers that want to take over the world is like it's light years. It's light years from where we are now. Now, if the pace of change increases and technological change does increase as fast as some people predict it is, that it's exponential instead of linear, maybe we cross that, you know, that distance faster than we expect. But a lot of very, very serious AI researchers think that that the mitigation that has to happen is around like the jobs that AI is going to take, but not around, you know, getting ourselves a neural interlace so that we can fight off the machines. Cricket.
She says.
Cricket.
Okay. All right. That's fine. Okay.
I mean, I want a neural interlace. I think that's pretty awesome. That's it. Okay. I'll move on. Mary Claire Tan has questions, as do I think we all, about the bond market.
I understand the stock market, more or less, but I'm utterly confused by the bond market. How are the bond and stock markets similar and different?
Yes.
What's the difference between U.S. treasuries and bonds? What influences bond prices and interest rates?
Wow. Okay. So, in order, in reverse order, actually, the relationship between U.S. bonds and interest rates is this. Bonds are the method by which market forces decide how much money is going to cost. And I put it that way because interest rates are, the words interest rate is just another way to say this is how much money costs. When you go to your bank and you get a loan and you borrow $100, they say that'll be 5% interest. You owe them $105. That $100 cost you $5. Interest rates are how much money costs. The bond market is the mechanism by which market forces, as embodied most prominently by American government debt, that is to say treasury bonds and treasury bills, that is how the market works. Investors and retirement funds and Wall Street banks, they all bid on those T-bills and T-bonds when they come up for auction on a regular basis, and however much the market is willing to pay, that reflects in the interest rate, and that is how your credit card rate gets set, that is how your mortgage rate gets set, all of those things. Interesting, trivial little fact, the 10-year Treasury note is the benchmark because most mortgages in the United States are either paid off or sold off at about 7 years, and so the 10-year is the closest official interest rate to that. Question number two. What is the relationship between U.S. treasuries and bonds? U.S. treasuries are bonds. Now, I will tell you that not all bonds are U.S. treasuries. Bonds can be issued by corporations. They can be issued by governments. There's my local school district is going to float a $145 million bond to pay for capital improvements. So any recognized and significant entity can issue a bond, provided they can find underwriters, right? Provided they can find people to take it to market. I'm not going to get into the mechanics of how bonds go to market because that, frankly, will make your head explode. But provided they can take it to market and get people to buy the bond, buy the debt. And let's remember, a bond is just a promise to pay you back your money at some point in the future with interest piled on top. That's all it is. So I have in my oldest son's file somewhere a Series EE Treasury bond for $100 that my uncle gave to him when he was like 6 months old. And then how are bonds like the stock market? They're really, 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 really different. The stock market is a good explainer of where people think companies' fortunes are going to go. And let's not get wrapped up in indices here and the Dow and the NASDAQ and all that jazz. Let's just talk the broader spectrum of stocks. They are basically bets on where companies' fortunes are going to go. And that goes back to the previous answer about earnings. If the company comes out with positive earnings, a stock price is going to go up and you'll be able to either buy it and pay some more or sell it and make a little money. The bond market is a different beast. And I'm speaking here specifically about the treasury market, right? Because the American government is the largest issuer of debt, of bonds in the world, because of this thing that you hear all the time when we have conversations about defaulting on our debt and the debt limit, because of this thing called the full faith and credit of the United States. The United States is still today, for all of our problems, the safest borrower of money in the world. We will pay you back. It might take 20 or 30 years, but we will pay you back. The thing about the bond market is this. It is a device and an animal and a beast that is subject to just a few controlling factors, right? One is the Federal Reserve. The other is the Congress and what it is doing. The other is the macro economy, what investors are thinking of the macro economy. And I'm not talking companies here. I'm talking specifically recessions or economic expansions. So when you think stock market, think companies. When you think the bond market, think the much bigger, more macro, national and global level economy. And that was the bond market.
How come, why do bonds, bond prices go up when the stock market goes down?
Well, so the easy answer is all that money coming out of stocks has to go somewhere, right? So people take the, and I, this is not moms and pops, right? It's largely institutional investors and people just trading, right? But they take the money out of stocks and in theory, they put it into the bond market to have some place to park it. The catch is that when bond prices go up, the yield goes down. And I'm absolutely not going to explain why, because it frankly makes my head hurt. But when people buy into the bond market, that is saying that they, first of all, they want some place to put their money, but they are okay with the state of things. It's a positive sign when people buy government bonds because they're feeling good about the macro economy, as I said. When that happens, the risk, the perceived risk goes down. That is to say, you need less reward for putting your money in bonds, and so the interest rate that those bonds pay goes down. That's how and why that happens. And vice versa. When people sell out of the bond market because they're not feeling good about, I don't know, nuclear war with North Korea, right?
Right.
Then yields go up because it's, oh my God, an unstable time.
Okay. Thanks.
There you go. We had some questions about Equifax, and here it is.
Hi, it's your producer, Jenny. I'm going to read you an email from Elizabeth on the L train in Chicago.
Wow.
And it's a question that I have a vested interest in getting answered as well. Would it make sense for information agencies like Equifax to be government-run entities like the IRS? Would the government be more likely to share information than Equifax has been or will be? These private companies seem technologically and ethically challenged in handling our data. And finally, what, if any, legislation is in place or in the works to protect us on a federal level? She ends by saying, sorry for the rant, a little salty as I am writing to you from an L train in Chicago. The AC is not working and it's 95 degrees out.
Ouch.
Ouch.
Man. Yeah. You want that one or am I doing this one? Who's doing
I
this
I could take
one?
Some of that one. I think we can ping pong this guy.
Tag team? All right, go ahead.
I will say I definitely don't want the IRS to be in charge of it because they're no better. Let's be honest. The federal government is no better at security. In fact, maybe arguably a little worse at cybersecurity than private companies. I think some combination. Wow.
It's a new word. We invented a new word.
At some point in our country, we have had strong laws that regulate financial institutions, right? And my assertion is that those laws should extend to credit reporting agencies because they are fundamentally financial services companies. Does that seem fair?
No, they totally are. And the catch is that now, as I'm sure you've heard in the coverage of Equifax, there is no federal level law to regulate those organizations, right? There are state level laws, which is why the disclosure periods are different and repercussions are different and all that stuff. But there is no federal law. And let me just pile on Molly's point about not putting this in government hands. First of all, as she said, the government is not at all any better at not being hacked than private companies are. But also, in a much more cynical vein, you would have to drag this business enterprise kicking and screaming away from the private sector lobbyists and groups that make money doing this, right? Because it's a huge, huge industry. And the idea that they're going to go softly into that good night when Congress says, oh, no, we're going to have the government do this, that's not going to happen.
Well, and also, I mean, the IRS is sort of already under fire for overstepping its power with data mining. And then, like Kai points out, this was a phenomenally profitable company. I mean, part of the reason that you had three executives selling $1.8 million in stock was because its share price had tripled over the last few years. I mean, tripled. And so there's probably no scenario in which this becomes a government-run service. And I am okay with that because of all the reasons I laid out. But I do think there needs to be And in fact, we know that some banking reforms after the 2008-2009 crisis included oversight and regulation of credit agencies that were then watered down. So clearly, there needs to be some move. Now, I will say that there is Elizabeth Warren has introduced at least one bill that would require credit agencies to let you freeze and unfreeze your credit for free. And then three other Democratic senators have introduced a bill that would regulate data brokers, which are the super shadowy companies that buy and sell your data, that would force them to be more transparent, regulate them, and let you opt out of having your data sold for marketing purposes. So we're starting to see some moves in terms of protecting our privacy. But in terms of an overarching regulation, and this is what still astonishes me, it is likely to come from the EU. I mean, any data protections that trickle down to the US consumer are likely to come as a result of something like a $10 billion fine levied against Facebook from the European Union, because we still have no moves toward an overarching set of regulations that would say, this is what you are allowed to collect about consumers. This is how you have to store it when you collect it. These are the rules for trading or sharing that information. And this is what happens when you have a breach. We don't have that at the federal level, and there seems to be no sign that we're going to get it anytime soon.
And oh, by the way, just for the record, as of this taping, the CEO of Equifax has been allowed to retire, effective today.
That's so nice. I will say, though, on the plus side, he's not getting a bonus this year.
That is true.
Because my only question as these executives fall is like, how big is the parachute for these folks?
That's Equifax.
That's Equifax for today. Another Elizabeth has a question for us. This is Elizabeth Anderson with a slightly more philosophical question.
Why don't our elected officials have any sort of licensure? The practice of medicine, law, and financial advisement all require study and testing of knowledge in order to do no harm to the American public. Why don't our elected officials have the same requirements?
Because of the Constitution.
That is philosophical, but yes, I guess so, right?
Yeah.
There are some rules and that's all there is.
Yeah. Constitution has requirements for the office of president. The Constitution has rules for House of Representatives and Senate, and that's it. And you can't. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of any further litmus test is the election process itself. And yes, it's got problems. Right. It's got problems with money and it's got problems with the rigidity of the two-party system. But all of that other stuff, any other kind of litmus test is supposed to be hashed out by the very public election process. You're supposed to be able to see who you're voting for and choose accordingly.
Which, oh, by the way, is why this Facebook and Russian interference and all of that matters, right? I mean, we could talk political campaigning till the cows come home, but the stuff that's happening without the electorate's knowledge, in this case, specifically Facebook, just to, you know, bring the business and tech side of this into this, that's why it's so significant.
Yeah.
That's why it's so significant.
I will say the other thing that is incredibly significant, though, and I hope it doesn't get lost in the conversations about Facebook, is voting itself. You know, because none of the electoral process doesn't shake out any of the kinks in the candidates unless everybody who is eligible to vote is allowed to vote. And so we are seeing sort of a parallel effort under the scenes to undermine the voting system in this country. And that is, to me, should be getting as much as more or more attention as Facebook, in my opinion.
There you go.
Now, oh, by the way. We only scratched the surface of the answers here, but that is, of course, what you are for in either a future show or as a response to this show. If there's something that you want people to know about any of these topics, because I'm sure that somebody out there knows way more about AI than I do, something you are an expert on, drop us a line at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can write to us right there on our website, makemesmart.org.
Back in probably 27 seconds.
All right. If those questions were not hard enough, we thought we'd just level up a little bit like Mario and have a few of you ask us questions live. And the first person on the phone is Allie Dirks, who does not, bless her heart, let a show go by without writing or tweeting us. And although there are no certified records, I think Allie may have been the first listener to get a Make Me Smart Pop Socket. Hi, Allie. This is so exciting.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi, Molly. I'm so excited. And hey, Kai.
Hey.
Okay, so my question has two parts. I've got a what part and then a why. What I want to know is what actually happens to my data when it's stolen in a hack? I remember Molly saying that it gets sold to data brokers who sell it to other data brokers. But what I really want to know is what's the end-to-end path it takes? Like, does it end up on the desk of some coder or somebody in a marketing department, that sort of thing? And then the why part is, why should I care? Obviously, identity theft is horrible and can ruin your life. But if my data is not being stolen for the purpose of stealing my identity, what's the actual day-to-day risk that I face if my data is stolen?
Yeah. That last part is almost, the last part is almost the philosophical question. And we talked about this on Marketplace Tech with a Harvard professor, I think, who was talking about how part of the reason that we don't get, for example, giant federal regulation after a hack of this size is because the impacts are not always obvious. They don't happen all at the same time. She said it would be one thing if we all logged in to our bank accounts the day after a hack like this and all our money was gone. Then you would have some legislation. You would have some large response. But it's a little bit of a trickle-down situation, because what you may find is somebody like our producer Jenny will have someone try to buy a computer on her credit card or sign her up for a bunch of email newsletters. The next person might have their identity theft stolen completely. That happened to me after the Target hack. Someone opened up a whole bunch of credit cards in my name, and I had to spend about a year getting them all closed and stopping Macy's in particular from sending me bills for these cards that were not in my name. And then somebody else might not have anything happen, but it's all this kind of swirling soup out there. And I think it does start to feel like a little bit of an abstract threat. Even though you might spend a lot of time trying to fix it, we're not usually liable. But, you know, in the worst case scenario, you can absolutely have your credit ruined and your bank account drained. I mean, it is really worth spending a little brain space worrying about it. Now, to the first part of your question, what happens with the information? It gets sold, and it gets sold in, I mean, it's weird to think of, but they essentially bundle this into just an individual file on a person. And it's almost just like a little ABC kit for identity theft. And if you're a hacker, you know, you spend some time on the dark web, you spend maybe $1.50, maybe $5, and you buy a packet of individual information about a person and you use it to open up credit card accounts and you use it to, you know, maybe reverse engineer a SIM card. Whatever it is you want to do, usually around trying to make purchases or make money, or just be in the, you know, there's all the middlemen who are simply in the brokerage business who are collecting the data, packaging it up, and then selling it, which is almost the best business to be in because it's the least work. I'm not suggesting that anybody go into that business, just to be clear. But that's what happens, is it gets bundled and then it gets sold. And then the hackers on the other end use it for whatever they want to do. And it could be as simple as even just taking over your computer, commandeering it, making it part of a botnet that runs a brute force hacking attack on some other system like the IRS.
Hey, Molly, how much time do you spend worrying about identity theft?
I don't spend that much time worrying about it, even though I had it happen.
Yeah.
It feels in a lot of ways like a bloodless crime, and it is hard to find examples of people who really truly have had their lives ruined or these ongoing problems. That's not to say that the problems aren't, you know, look, if when it inevitably happens to me again, I will spend a lot of time trying to fix it. And that's annoying. And one of those problems could follow me around for the rest of life and my life and damage my credit. But in the pantheon of things I'm worried about right now, it's not that high on the list. I just want these companies to protect my stuff.
Allie, that hook you up?
Yeah, that's a lot to chew on. Thank you so much, guys.
You bet. Thanks for hanging with us.
All right. Bye, guys.
And finally, Pam Poschel, who I believe is on the line now, has a question. Also, Pam, thank you for the granola. It was spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Yummy.
You are so welcome. My question is about the sequester. Does the Trump tax proposal take that into account?
Dang. Pam is throwing down.
Maybe we ought to remind people what the sequester is, right? Four-ish years ago, might have been longer than that, Congress realized that it was fundamentally not able to control its own spending. That's not a new thing with Congress. It's not an old thing. It's a fact of life with Congress. And so they said, listen, here's what we're going to do. We are going to put this procedure into place whereby if we don't make the budget cuts in a sane and rational manner that we are expected to do as citizens in a representative democracy and lawmakers, then we're just going to have the system automatically do it. We're going to write into law certain cuts to, say, defense and social spending and all kinds of things so that our hands are tied. And the theory was that the threat of the sequester would then force Congress to get its act together on government spending and how we do things in this country and make rational decisions. As we all know, that didn't happen. Those sequester cuts went into effect, and they are still in effect. And Pam, the short answer to your question is I cannot answer that question because we don't yet know what the tax reform package is going to be from the White House and from the Congress. We are taping this on a Tuesday. We are told by the president this morning that he's going to have a detailed package out tomorrow. But you know what? That's like him saying we're going to have a plan for it in 2 weeks. They keep promising things, the White House and Congress, congressional Republicans do, and we just don't get them. I would be surprised if in rewriting the Internal Revenue Code, they get into a budgeting item like the sequester. Now, there is a budget that has to be taken care of come December, right? We're on a three-month continuing resolution, and so by the end of the year, Congress is going to have to figure out its budget plan. I would not anticipate that they will do anything about the sequester. I could be completely wrong, but it's not going to be part of the tax package, and I'd be really surprised if they take it on at the end of the year in the budget plan. That's just the sad truth.
Hmm. Gotcha. The sequester has a time period, right? Isn't it? It was for like a certain number of years.
I think it was, but...
Do they have to remove it before they can go forward, or do they just let it run out?
I don't know the answer to that one. I don't know the answer to that one. Usually these things do sunset. I'm not sure what the requirements are on that one.
Yes, pass to Tony.
Oh, my goodness. There it was. That was the toss to Tony. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to look that up, Pam, and we'll put it up at makemesmart.org or marketplace.org/makemesmart. And then we'll tweet it out at you and just let people know it's out there. But, yeah, that was a good question, whether it sunsets and what has to happen. I should know the answer to that one, actually.
We will. We'll know soon. Thanks, Pam.
Thanks.
Well, thank you all very much. Have fun.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my God, that was so fun. If we had all day, I would ask her how she likes to eat the granola. Like, is it a yogurt thing or heavy cream? Anyway, I tried it so many different ways. Bananas on top. Next up, Kai and I have some questions for each other. But before that, we have to pay the bills. Kai, I have a question for you.
All right, shoot.
This is just going to be super annoying because it's probably not even fair to ask you, but I just need to know. What does single payer mean?
What?
In the single payer healthcare conversation.
Oh, my God. Single payer.
What does single payer? Who's the payer? I know this is just like the dumbest thing ever, but.
Here's the catch. So single payer, which is, of course, the plan that Bernie Sanders and 16 other wannabe president Democrats came out with about 10 days, 2 weeks ago. The single payer in single payer is the government of the United States. Mm. It is, in essence, a government-paid-for healthcare program paid for by, yes, people's taxes. Now, there's about 97,342 different layers to that, none of which, I should point out, were answered in Bernie Sanders' bill, right? The question is, dear Senator Sanders, how are you going to pay for this? If the government's going to pay for everybody's healthcare, how are you going to pay? And he said, oh, we'll do something about taxes. So, there is going to have to be some kind of tax methodology to pay for single payer, which is where it runs into problems. But let's talk about what it means for a second. So first of all, people who are on government-sponsored healthcare right now, which is generally speaking Medicaid and Medicare, right, which is for low-income and disabled people and also the elderly, that stays. But the 100-plus million Americans who are on employee health programs through work, that goes away too. That goes away, too, when everybody gets on the government plan. Mm. So if you thought the ACA was disruptive, and granted it was, holy cow, single payer will be a whole nother ball of wax. But the single payer in single payer is the government, and it is, as Senator Sanders promised, government health care for all.
Okay.
So, there you go.
Thank you. I love it. We should do a whole show on that. That was really interesting.
Here's my question. You ready?
Yep.
How did you become a technology reporter?
Oh, really? That's where you're going to go now? I feel like a big jerk.
Yeah.
I could have asked about you.
No, it's fine.
That's all right. Although it is a sort of a set. It's like if you had moved to California during the gold rush, you would have become a gold miner.
There you go.
I moved here in 1999 at the height of the technology industry as a sort of pseudo out of work journalist because I just moved here on a whim. And I got hired by a magazine that covered Apple products. And that was that. And since I had done a lot of sports reporting, it felt kind of familiar to me. I was like, oh, it's like a lot of numbers and there's dudes everywhere. Practically the same job.
Oh, that is so interesting.
Yeah. But I mean, I really liked it.
Yeah.
It won me over.
Well, that's as is clear by how good you are at it and the fact that you're still doing it.
Oh, get right out of the seat. Now I'm all, what single payer? Jeez, Kai.
All right. Now, your turn to answer the question we ask pretty much everybody we run across. Here it is.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
I love that sting so much. Zachary Gustafson is a Make Me Smart listener who heard that question. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? And he asked it, I love this guy, to a bunch of his colleagues at work.
At a spring gathering of my global team, I asked each of them, as well as our guest speakers throughout the week, to answer the Make Me Smart question. We got some great answers that I wanted to share with you. We learned about dealing with small humans, things like, I thought I was ready to have kids. I thought I knew how to play with my kids until they started to legitimately beat me. And I thought I would be the teacher of my much younger siblings, but it turns out they teach me as much as I teach them. We heard some straight-up misconceptions, like, I thought everyone on U.S. currency notes were former U.S. presidents. I thought that sounding good in the car meant that I could do karaoke. And I thought that a new potato was a type of potato, but it turns out it's just a very young potato. And we heard some things on self-awareness, like, I thought I knew how to handle stress. I thought I knew how to cook until I went to a cooking class. And I thought I knew who I was. And then my own answer, which was coincidentally duplicated by our CEO later in the week. Not saying, just saying. I thought bulletproof logic would always carry the day. Mm-hmm. But it turns out persuasion is personal and emotional. Less about facts and logic, more about trust, shared values, and being on the same team. Which, of course, brings us back around to the righteous mind. I didn't read the book, though I did listen to the pod twice to make up for it, but I have read Haidt's other book, The Happiness Hypothesis, because said CEO, he gives a copy of it to every new employee.
Wow.
Thanks for a great show and for making us all a little bit smarter.
That was like a freaking great radio show all by itself. That was beautiful.
That was super fun.
I'm going to get that book too. That looks really interesting.
Super fun. Really good, Zach. Thanks, man. That was really cool.
If you, too, would like to make us a beautifully crafted little radio show and send it to us, voice memo alert, our book club episode is October 10th. So if you voted for The Man in the High Castle and you read it, send us an email or, better yet, a voice memo with your thoughts and your questions and your concerns and your reviews and your what is this about kind of thoughts. As you can tell, we have lots to talk about. We've actually had to restrain ourselves from having The Man in the High Castle talk several times. If you can get us your voice memos or emails by October 6th, that would be amazing. Make me smart at marketplace.org.
Also, just here's another ask. If you have a second, go to Apple Podcasts, review us, tell a friend, subscribe. And also, you can do that and listen to old episodes of the show, too, or turn your friends onto it that way. That's a good way to sort of dig right in.
Yeah, totally. Go back to the Righteous Mind episode. You'll love it. Yep.
All right, there we go. That was the Explainathon. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fergali. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
I love Explainathon. Let's do that again. The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and I feel certain she'll agree. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Yeah, that was all right. And for the record, I think I'm the one...
Yeah,
I'm the one who got stumped, right? Isn't that where we are? I'm the one who got stumped. All right. Not that it's a contest.
You had to phone a Tony.
I did. Well, he got phoned for me.
I mean, I made up a whole bunch of that stuff about AI, so. No, just kidding.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.